Mansion, South Dakota residence. Everything is fine. Everything is beautiful. Go back to your homes. Go back to your jobs. Trust in the authority.
Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep.
Keeping you docile and distracted during times of uncertainty. This is the South Dakota Department of Propaganda Podcast.
First off, the article discusses a ranking by safehome.org that determines the safety of all 50 states, plus Washington, D.C., for LGBTQ plus people. This ranking system considers both legislative measures and FBI hate crime data.
They've taken into account various categories such as parenting freedoms, non-discrimination rights, health laws, and more. They've also analyzed hate crimes committed against LGBTQ plus individuals in each state using FBI data.
Now let's talk about the ranking. Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and Delaware rated highest for LGBTQ plus safety according to this methodology. Rhode Island in particular got an A plus rating largely because of its comprehensive protection laws and low incidence of hate crimes.
On the other hand, South Dakota and Florida scored lowest on this scale. South Dakota in particular has more laws that are anti-equality than pro-equality, and a relatively high incidence of reported hate crimes against LGBTQ plus individuals.
Another interesting tidbit from the article is about the presence of openly LGBTQ plus legislators in Alaska, which aligns with the state's general direction of progressiveness.
Meanwhile, Hawaii secured a place in the top five safest states for LGBTQ plus Americans due to its strong legal protections and low rates of reported hate crimes.
Unfortunately, not all is rosy. States like Wyoming and Ohio have low scores for LGBTQ plus safety due to their few pro-equality laws and high rates of hate crimes. Wyoming specifically lacks many pro-equality laws, which has contributed to its low position in the safety ranking.
In Alabama, anti-equality laws, such as one that prohibits teacher-led discussions on sexual orientation and gender identity in elementary schools, have contributed to its low ranking.
Despite these challenges, there's hope as advocates are making progress even in states with low rankings. For instance, in South Dakota, a transgender advocacy group successfully sued the state for discrimination.
The article ends by reminding us all that everyone deserves to feel safe, but there's still much work to be done to ensure equality under the law for LGBTQ plus Americans.
South Dakota recently held a primary election, and the turnout was historically low at 17%, the lowest since the state began combining presidential primaries with other primary races in 2000. This is raising concerns about the resources spent for such low turnout.
For example, each ballot cast in Lyman County cost an estimated $134 in taxpayer money, with just over 6% of registered voters turning out. The county spent about $9,000 on ballot printing, hiring election workers, and other costs.
Similarly, in Hughes County, which includes the capital city of Pierre, each of its 304 ballots cast cost roughly $70 in taxpayer funds. The county had less than 5% voter turnout.
Those numbers sound bad, but when we take into account that there were no statewide Republican races to vote on and the only statewide race on the Democratic ballot was the presidential primary, the low turnout starts to make sense.
This could be considered as an unusual situation rather than a lack of voter interest. Taking this into account, a 27% turnout among Republicans and 7% among Democrats and non-politically affiliated voters could be seen as actually pretty good.
Even so, these low turnouts have sparked discussions about change. One of the proposed solutions is open primaries that include all candidates for an office running in one primary regardless of their party. Supporters argue that closed primaries disenfranchise large numbers of voters.
A big concern is whether these low turnout figures are representative of the will of the people. Are those who are elected truly reflecting the wishes of the majority or just those select few who do vote?
It was also noted that many of the counties with high voter turnout had nonpartisan issues on the ballot, which might have attracted more voters. So there's still a lot to consider here.
So while this year's low turnout can be partially explained, it's still a wake-up call to all of us about the importance of participating in the democratic process and making our voices heard.
According to a recent poll, exactly 50% of respondents said Trump's guilty verdict was the right choice made by the New York jury, with 49% suggesting he should immediately exit the presidential race. Despite this, Trump's favorability remains unchanged at about 31%, both before and after the conviction.
The charges against Trump are related to hush money payments made prior to the 2016 elections, intended to conceal alleged past affairs. The poll shows that the trial is divisive, with just under half of respondents agreeing with Trump that the charges are politically motivated.
Interestingly, 51% believe Trump intentionally did something wrong in this case, and 12% think he did something wrong unintentionally. Just 18% of Republicans agreed with the guilty verdict, while 83% of Democrats agreed. Among independents, a significant voting group, 52% agree with the guilty verdict.
Meanwhile, President Biden remains unpopular according to the poll, with a 32% approval rating, which is nearly identical to Trump's approval rating. This is a slight decrease from his approval rating from a month ago.
How much is the doggy in the window? Christie hopes that doggy's for sale. If she had that doggy in the window, she'd shoot him and cut off his tail. If she had 100 Dalmatians, that's plenty of puppies to kill. It's normal there in South Dakota, says Governor Christie DeVille. She still has a kitten and a hamster. They're lucky if they stay alive. If ever they mess up on the carpet, they'll meet with her Colt 45. She says she's not apologetic, that we are besmirching her good name. She's packing to go off on safari, 'cause tigers and dogs are the same. She did it to show Trump she is forceful. So don't think she's sorry, she's not. Her hope is he'll choose her for his VP, but it looks like her chances are shot. Remember that puppy in the window, the one you brought home for your kids. Think back when that dog ate up your tax forms, sent Fifi across the rainbow bridge. So hold your condolence for this governor and loss of the pet from her home. I fear, be it ever so jumbled, in D.C. there's no place for gnome. How much is that doggy in the window? Christie hopes that doggy's for sale. If she had that doggy in the window, she'd shoot him and cut off his waggly tail.
the Affordable Connectivity Program, or ACP, which has been a lifeline for rural and low-income households in America, is unfortunately out of funds. They provided 30 monthly subsidies for internet bills or 75 discounts in high-cost or travel areas.
That's correct. It was launched during the pandemic, with the goal of connecting more people to their jobs, schools, and doctors. Over 23 million households signed up for it, including Myrna Broncos, whose story we read about in this article.
The story of Myrna highlights just how important an internet connection can be. After breaking her leg, she used her home internet to keep track of records and appointments and to communicate with her medical team.
But with the ACP running out of money, there's been a lot of debate on Capitol Hill. Senator John Thune has challenged the continuation of the program's funding, stating that it needs to be revamped as it doesn't direct support exclusively to those who need it most.
Despite this, both Democrats and Republicans are pushing for new legislative action. Meanwhile, President Biden's administration is encouraging companies like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast to offer low-cost plans to ACP enrollees.
It's a pressing issue indeed. Many households may have to make tough choices without these subsidies. The Federal Communications Commission warns that the program's end will impact about 3.4 million rural and over 300,000 households in tribal areas.
As this continues to develop, we remind our listeners of the importance of affordable internet access in today's digital society.
Shots are heard. Christie's killing some birds. Lots of dead animals on display. No, no, on the range. She's a governor who loves gunplay. When gunshots are heard, no one dares say a word. MAGA drives normal people away. When the gun smoke is strong, they will all get along. Neighbors' hens laying eggs all night. Till Christie shows up with an unrestrained pup. And the bird dog kills the birds with her bite. No, no, on the range, where common sense and gun lust part ways. When gunshots are heard, Christie's thinning the herd. Target practice goes on every day. How often she fires, fresh kills she desires. She aspires to see blood flowing red. Christie quivers with rage as she aims her 12-gauge. Soon she'll fire and collect all the dead. No, no, on the range, firearms are the name of the game. Where hunting is cool and the governor's a fool, and poor Cricket must take all the
The South Dakota primary election saw a record low turnout, with fewer than 2 in 10 voters casting their votes. This is largely attributed to the Republican and Democratic presidential nominees being already decided and the lack of U.S. Senate or House primaries to spark voter interest.
This low turnout trend isn't new. In fact, South Dakota's voter turnout has been on a decline since 2008 when it was at 37%. On Tuesday, only 100,999 ballots were cast out of 591,153 registered voters in the state. That's just 17%, way below the state's primary turnout in previous presidential cycles.
Consider this: of those nearly 101,000 ballots cast, only around 20,000 were from Democratic or independent voters who aren't allowed to vote in GOP primaries over there. This is due partly to South Dakota being a deep red state and also to a lack of competition among Democratic candidates.
This lack of competition is not just for the primary elections. GOP primary winners ran unopposed in 21 of the 35 state Senate races in 2022, and it's been 14 years since a Democrat last won a statewide election in South Dakota.
But it wasn't all doom and gloom for the Democrats. The article mentions that Joe Kirby, an election reform advocate, is leading an effort to establish top two open primaries for governor, Congress, and state legislative and county races through Constitutional Amendment H.
If successful, all candidates would run against each other regardless of party affiliation in one primary election for each designated office. The top two vote-getters would then advance to the general election.
This primary was also dominated by the issue of landowner rights due to a legislative debate over its use for underground carbon pipeline projects. This debate led to significant Republican turnover and set the tone for power clashes in Pierre.
Among those who lost their seats were several incumbent Republicans who had voted for Senate Bill 201, legislation allowing the Public Utilities Commission to override local regulations on pipelines. Critics saw this as favoring the ethanol industry over landowners.
There were some wins for mainstream Republicans, too, though. Stephanie Sauter defeated fellow House member Fred Deutsch in District 4 Senate race, while Amber Hulse ousted incumbent Julie Frey-Mueller in Senate District 30.
The article wraps up indicating that while landowner rights and pipelines have become hot-button issues galvanizing Republicans, hand-counting election initiatives fell short with voters rejecting measures for paper ballots only in three counties.
That's certainly quite a bit to digest.
South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem has come under fire for her controversial new book, No Going Back: The Truth on What is Wrong with Politics and How We Move America Forward. Critics, including a state lawmaker and community advocate Julian Bouyan, are challenging Noem's accounts of two Black Lives Matter protests that happened in 2020.
These protests took place in Sioux Falls and Washington, D.C., and Noem's descriptions don't seem to match up with reality. Critics argue that her narrative is exaggerated and inaccurate. In fact, her publishers have already had to make corrections to other parts of the book where she falsely claimed to have met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and incorrectly stated that Senator Mike Rounds opposed Donald Trump's 2016 presidential race.
One major point of contention is her description of the protest in Washington, D.C., which coincided with former President Donald Trump's acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention. Noem describes a scene filled with explosions, screams, and tear gas. However, media reports contradict this account, describing the protest as largely peaceful.
Similarly, Noem's account of the protest in Sioux Falls has been called into question. She claims that hundreds of bikers stood with police during the demonstration, a detail that others who were present dispute. Julian Bouyan, who helped plan the Sioux Falls protest, denies any significant presence of bikers.
The issue here isn't just about discrepancies in details. Critics argue that Noem's depictions of these protests are misleading and damaging. Michael Card, a political professor at the University of South Dakota, suggests that Noem's accounts could be a political strategy to support Trump's law and order message during a time when the country was grappling with police brutality.
Bouyan goes further to describe Noem's accounts as clearly racist, saying that she is trying to negatively impact progress made by Black and brown communities. The fact that her accounts have been disputed by multiple sources raises serious questions about the accuracy of her narratives and why she chose to present them in this way.
Despite these criticisms, Noem stands by her book, stating that she appreciates the free advertising for her New York Times bestseller. Critics continue to challenge her accounts as they believe these inaccuracies can have real-world impacts on social progress and political discourse.
There has been a significant shakeup in the South Dakota Republican state legislative races, with voters showing a strong opposition to pipeline supporters. In total, 14 incumbents were ousted, causing a ripple effect through the leadership of the state's Republican Party.
That includes both Senator Casey Crabtree and Rep. Will Mortensen, who had invested heavily in a slate of candidates they favored. However, all of Mortensen's whips who ran for election were defeated, leading to speculations that they may lose their majority leader positions next year.
It wasn't all doom and gloom, though. Some familiar faces also made a comeback. Former Speaker of the House Spencer Gosch and incumbent Scott Moore came out on top, along with Taffy Howard, who survived a challenge in District 34.
The biggest issue that led to these results was Summit Carbon Solutions' proposed pipeline to move carbon dioxide across eastern South Dakota. Public sentiment against the pipeline was strong and led to the defeat of many incumbents who seemed to favor the project.
This opposition to the pipeline also spurred political newbies like Joy Hone and Mark Latka into action. Their anti-pipeline stance resonated with voters, and they both won their races convincingly over carbon pipeline-friendly candidates.
In essence, voters were looking for change, and they made that absolutely clear through these elections. It was a grassroots revolt that sent a strong message against politics as usual.
The results of this election could have far-reaching implications, even setting the stage for a completely different House and Senate by 2025. The public's clear opposition to certain business interests could lead to important policy changes as well.
While there were some wins for the conservative faction of the party, it wasn't an outright victory for them. Some leaders from this faction indeed faced defeat in very closely watched races.